So all three reasons here are pretext, whether they're based on lies, truth, or half-truth, because they're not the real reason, that he wants her fired because she is pregnant. And the reason why I'm taking time to highlight this is because a lot of times when you talk to people about pretext, they automatically think that has to be based on a lie. And Chris Benoit reminded us yesterday that Bostock says there can be multiple causes for an adverse action. So think about that when you're trying to evaluate the different reasons that defendants give. So why should we care? Why do we care about these definitions? Why do we care about pretext so much? Well, it's all about proof. So imagine for a second that you had to prove discrimination. Or if you've ever felt discriminated against, how would you go about verbalizing why you felt that way? Evidence of pretext is our proof. That's all it is. It can be direct evidence. It can be circumstantial evidence. And in many cases, evidence of pretext or proof of pretext is going to be the most important issue. Why? Well, for disparate treatment cases, the courts have said that we have to show that the discrimination was intentional. How do you show intentional discrimination if the defendant doesn't right out admit that they did something based on an illegal factor? Well, the Supreme Court has said that proof of pretext is all the jury needs to find intentional discrimination. I have a quote here from the Supreme Court case, Reeves versus Sanderson Plumbing, explaining that concept. And after this quote, the court goes on to say something to the effect of, this should make sense. The employer is the one that's in the best position to put forward the reason. If that justification or that reason is then eliminated, then it may very well have been intentional discrimination. Now, courts in Texas obviously follow this Reeves principle, and as a result, our pattern jury charges in the Fifth Circuit and also the state court pattern jury charges include what's known as a Reeves instruction. It's also known as a permissive pretext instruction. Here's an example of that instruction from a jury charge. This is actually B.B. Sanford's case that Jason mentioned yesterday. She presented yesterday. As a side note, in this case, they granted $70 million to the plaintiffs. It was 10 different plaintiffs. It was a Section 1981 case, so there are no caps. But anyway, this is an example of the instruction. There's a circuit split about whether this instruction is mandatory. In the Fifth Circuit, it is mandatory. And here's an example of the instruction from the state court pattern jury charges. This particular case was tried in March of this year. It was a retaliation case. So there's not a whole lot of difference between the language in the state and federal instructions. But a warning for the age discrimination instruction in the Fifth Circuit pattern instructions. Take a look at this highlighted language. So it's different from all of the other discrimination claim instructions. And it's allowing the jury but not requiring them to find discrimination even when they've found that the reason is pretext for discrimination. That's the plaintiff's entire case. I'm not sure what else the plaintiff would have to show or to prove discrimination. So just be really careful with this. It's at odds with the other instructions, and it might be a reversible error. All right, so we talked about pretext in the jury instructions. Before you get to the trial, the plaintiff's going to have to pass summary judgment. This is Mr. Green from the McDonnell Douglas case. I'm sure a lot of you are familiar with that framework. So at its basic application, The framework requires up to 3 steps. All 3 steps are not always required. Something to keep in mind is the framework was meant to be applied fluidly. When the framework was created, it was created for judges to be able to have some kind of guidelines to determine whether or not there was discrimination. That's the whole point. And this was before we had a right to a jury trial in these cases. So first is the prima facie case. It's not meant to be a set of rigid elements that are applied. The Supreme Court has said repeatedly it's not supposed to be an onerous burden. It should be tailored to the many different factual scenarios that plaintiffs face. But sometimes some judges do apply a rigid set of factors to the prima facie case. And if the plaintiff cannot make out the prima facie case, but the defendant gives a reason anyway, then what happens to the burden of the prima facie case burden? Well, the Supreme Court says that at that point, then, it doesn't matter whether or not the plaintiff made out a prima facie case. All that matters is whether or not there was discrimination. I have a quote here from the Aiken Supreme Court case.